Tonight it's my pleasure to welcome to Many Rivers Books and Tea Rick Whitney. This is his first appearance at Many Rivers. He has a novel, Align It. And it is part adventure, travelogue, mystery, science fiction, and romance. We will be hearing more about it, its genesis, I believe, and even more about Mr. Whitney as well in the course of this discussion. And I am delighted to welcome Rick Whitney to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Thank you. Align It is a novel that I wrote and published in 2014. It is a travelogue. It is a kind of a utopian adventure. It's written kind of in the adventure narrative type. The story takes place over a week-long period, and it's an exploration of a different kind of civilizational potential. Somewhat science fiction, somewhat utopian, but very much grounded in our world today, in fact, in the Bay Area. It's set somewhat in the near future, but it's based on a real place that I fictionalized in Richmond, California. It's a campus of UC Berkeley. It's a sort of a satellite campus taken over by the engineering school. So that's Bayside Village, and it's a place where all kinds of weird and wonderful social experiments, technologies, and spiritual teachings are being cultivated as though there are seeds to be planted for something new to grow. The story is, the protagonists in the story are Greg and Sarah. They're in their 30s. They have a daughter, Tara. They live in Seattle, Washington, and they are traveling from Seattle to visit this strange place called Bayside Village. It sort of begins a little bit in a dystopian vein because they're arriving in Oakland Airport, driving up the highway and looking at all the graffiti on the train tracks and everything and saying, what is this we're coming to? And when they get onto the campus, things start to shift and it begins to be, oh, this is what we came to. What I'm trying to do is to bring together sort of a spiritual impulse and a looking very closely and acutely at spiritual teachings as possible as an impetus for civilizational change, and then also the Bayside Village is a place where things can be incubated practically and implemented. So it's not just a sort of a romantic move out to the woods. It's something that's right in the middle of the Bay Area, right in the technological community. There's interaction with UC Berkeley. And so it's a place to incubate new ideas. Greg, one of the two protagonists, is a professor of ontology at University of Washington in Seattle. Ontology is the study of, it's both a discipline in philosophy, and it's also a discipline in computer science. And I've chosen it because it touches both of those disciplines. Ontology is the study of what exists and how those existing things relate to other things that exist. It is also the study of the properties, structure, function of existing things and relationships of existing things. So this is a classical branch of philosophy. Going back to Aristotle, it's ontology is a part of metaphysics, and one of my that's actually my own background is philosophy and religion. That's the area of my study, and I've always had an interest in how to, you know, it's one thing to study philosophy kind of off somewhere in a monastery or in an ashram or something like this, but how to actually bring this into day-to-day life in a society like American society that doesn't really have doesn't mirror spiritual teaching in any great depth and doesn't reflect it, doesn't honor it in some way. And certainly spiritual teachings like those that have come from the East into the West in the last few decades are not really integral to mainstream culture, to civilization. So that's also why I was interested in ontology as a in its connection with computer science, because now you have a bridge between ancient philosophy and modern science. Ontology is used very much today, it's studied quite extensively at Stanford, for instance, medical informatics, bioinformatics. A lot of companies are interested in ontology. The web is increasingly, especially the semantic web, is going to be based much more on ontology. So I found a bridge between ancient philosophy and modern science, and I'm exploiting that bridge in the novel. Greg is a professor of ontology. He is being recruited to come look at Bayside Village and come look at this new technology being developed there called Alignit. Alignit is the title of the book. It is also a technology platform. It's an ontology platform, and Roger Barnes is the inventor of this technology platform. He's interested, Roger Barnes, it lives at Bayside Village, and Greg, he knows, is not only an ontologist, but also a spiritual practitioner, a meditator, somebody who's had deep esoteric teaching, like he has, like many other people at Bayside Village have, and it's very difficult to recruit the right kind of person. So Greg, in Roger's view, is the right kind of person. He's recruiting Greg. Sarah, Greg's wife, is very much interested also in esoteric philosophy, spiritual tradition, spiritual practice, and she is also grounded in modern life in that she's an industrial designer in a high-tech firm, a boutique high-tech design firm in Seattle. So they both have a common set of values of trying to find ways of integrating spiritual life into everyday, spiritual practice into everyday life. But Sarah's a little bit unsure about going to Bayside Village. She's fine with their life as it is in Seattle, and after all, Greg is on the tenure track in his faculty role there. He's expecting to get tenure at University of Washington, so what's this about a move to Bayside Village? You give up tenure, you know, we have a family life here, everything is good, and the novel takes place over this week-long period where Greg and Sarah are interviewing, exploring, and all kinds of things happen. And this is where the traditional travelogue motif, a sort of the French term is, I can't say it in French, it's Fantastic Voyages. It's kind of it's a motif. So they're on this journey. They're going here for a week, and they're meeting with all kinds of sages and gurus and people interested in setting up alternative social experiments. That's by way of overview of the novel. I wanted to read a few sections, and then I thought we might have some discussion if some interest gets piqued on some points. Let me just make sure I've covered a few other things. I said about ontology, and align it. Okay, so in the novel, Roger Barnes, who is the developer of Align It, says to people, because a lot of people come to Bayside Village to look at this place. I should say something about Bayside Village. It's a utopian community by design. It was started 6 years ago, invested in by philanthropists. It's been built up very quickly talk about the relationship between utopian and dystopian themes. It's built on an old campus that was an industrial campus. So there's a lot of industrial waste, a lot of toxic sludge. This actually is true of the parcel that is the real parcel I have in mind that I fictionalized for the novel. There used to be a chemical company on site before the University of California bought it. So this is even part of the process of transforming something. You see this parcel of land that is toxic, and they're building a utopian community, a model community. The design of the community is to start experiments and then find partners in the larger world, first of all, to prove the principle of whatever experiment they're developing. These would be social experiments, economic experiments, experiments in recasting spiritual teachings or moving them in a different way in accordance with the evolution of consciousness, and their role at Bayside Village is to incubate, but not necessarily to scale these at a societal level. So they are looking for partners in other places to help, once the principle is proven, to scale up and integrate into mainstream dominant institutions. This is part of their vision of civilizational shift. So that is the Bayside Village. And it also has a graduate research institute called the Bridge Institute. They're trying to reconceive the university, partly on models of ancient Eastern universities like Nalanda, a great Buddhist university. There are a whole bunch of other universities they are sort of patterning on, but they want it to be integral, not just a university of one religion like Christianity or Buddhism or Vedanta or yoga. And it is also a research institute focused on scientific research. And how is it possible? The whole novel is also about the recovery of sacred sciences. And by sacred sciences, I mean, you could say pre-modern sciences, although what I'm interested in is being able eventually to eschew the pre-modern designator, to be able to say, these are sciences. And what makes them sacred is the connection to robust metaphysics and cosmology. Ancient sciences were not, the shift between ancient pre-modern sciences to modern sciences was eschewing metaphysics and cosmology and really focusing on what is empirically verifiable. That's one way to look at it. So this is about not going back in time to frozen ancient medieval sciences that we've evolved since then, but how do we reconnect metaphysics and cosmology to these older sciences and to newer sciences? Could we study protein to protein interactions and again have a greater metaphysics and cosmology, for instance? So that is the context, the setting, the community in which all these.
I just want to ask a question. So how much of the Bayside Village is fictionalized versus an actually existing organization?
It's completely fictionalized.
Okay.
Yeah,
I wanted to be clear about that.
Yeah, there's no such thing. The campus, yeah. the physical parcel of land that I've actually walked on and worked on and worked with faculty on and so on, is real. But that's about the end of it.
Okay.
Yeah. Hi, welcome. I should say I work at UC Berkeley, but very little that I'm developing in the novel is being done at UC Berkeley. Roger Barnes, Bayside Village receives a lot of guests, a lot of visitors, a lot of people coming to see what's going on there, what's brewing, how can we. This is the new thing. This is the new Esalen, maybe. You know, this is the new place where people are being drawn. If you're into something new, it's going on here. So let's go to Bayside Village to find out what's going on. So they have a lot of tours, orientation tours. This week that the novel takes place in is one such tour, and it's kind of an orientation, an open house. And Greg and Sarah have aligned their visit with Roger and Bayside Village to coincide with this larger orientation. Roger, the inventor of Alignit, often says to people, if you want to understand Alignit, because it's very abstract, it's an ontology platform, what does that mean? You know, in ordinary speech, that doesn't mean anything to anybody. And ontology is very abstract, it's arcane. Even in the technological world, ontologies operate in the background. They're not products, they're not services. Nobody talks about ontologies except specialists. So, Roger's aware of this. So how do you convey what an ontology is and what its importance is? So there are applications built on the technology platform that is called Alignit. One such is a platform in a company called Gamit. So it has kind of the same branding as Alignit. So Roger says to people, if you want to see what Alignit looks like, look at Gamit. So I wanted to kick off with a reading that is about Gamit. It's a meeting with Greg and the founder of Gamit, Jeff Baker. So through the week, Roger is meeting with different people, exploring, if I moved here with my wife, Sarah, if we moved here, you are somebody I would possibly be working with. Tell me what you do. Tell me how you work with Alignit. Tell me how blah, 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 because Greg would be a consultant. He would be a consultant to Roger on the Alignit technology platform, which is being, there's two ways it's being developed. One is academically in the Bridge Institute as a research program. The other is practically as a technology commons in a business park in the Bayside Village. So Roger, Greg wants to touch base with all these different people that he might consult with. And so Jeff Baker is one of them. And this is one way into the novel, is just sort of an introduction to this this game world. Oh, and so this scene is taking place in the business park in Jeff Baker's office. He's the founder of Gamet. He's in the Gamet office. And Greg and Jeff are sitting, they're talking. Greg is going to give a demo. They have been talking a little bit, kind of just breaking the ice and saying, this is what I do, this is what you do, and so on. So now there's, Jeff is about to give a demo. Okay, Jeff waved the mobile peripheral projections back in front of him. Well, give us your best feedback, and we'll have an interesting discussion. Why don't you put this on, he said, handing Greg the gear. All the gear is outfitted with flexible sensors, of course, to track your movements, pulse, blood pressure, brain waves, eye movements. You know the drill. Okay, Greg suited up. First, let's run through a little demo, and then we'll fire up one of the games. Jeff projected a game console on the on the table. They don't have physical peripherals. They're projecting images, and then the monitor is reading the finger movements as though it was receiving impressions from keys. He touched a button to turn on the room, select options, and set up the game demo. The room lights dimmed. Symphonic music arose and flowed through the room. The ceiling projectors turned on, and images were projected ubiquitously throughout the room. Scenes appeared and faded in quick succession. Gardens, deserts, mountains, palaces, cities. Planets from star systems rotated above the table. Stunningly beautiful, strong, and grotesque characters paraded around the walls. The displays were vivid, brilliant. Then, in 3D holographic images, warriors suddenly appeared at the doors. First Roman centurions, then Japanese shogun. And on it went, one type of soldier morphing into another. Fabulous beasts appeared, flying, running, swimming above the chairs and across the room. Human figures of all kinds, male and female, donning all manner of costumes, appeared about the room. Standing, running, laughing, fighting, loving. Plants shot up from the carpet. Earthquakes appeared to open up the floor, and a tsunami appeared to come at Greg and Jeff from a far wall. The room quieted. A woman's voice spoke, while images shimmered faintly, and quieter symphonic music supported her voice. Prepare to enter the Egyptian Palace, part of the Gamet Mastery series, a suite of immersive archetypal training games with electrifyingly stunning game worlds and figures. Gamet will draw you into challenging episodes where you'll confront the naughtiest mysteries of human existence. You will execute fascinating game tasks, follow opportunities, avoid threats, and contend with dangerous seductions. Beware, for you will meet magicians, tricksters, heroes, charlatans, and fabulous beasts. You'll meet engineers, titans of industry, and captains of starships and their crews. You will be helped and tricked, challenged and tested, loved and maybe harmed. Who are your real friends and who are the foes? Can you discern one from the next? You may run, you may hide, but you cannot run from yourself. They can seduce you or help you, hurt you or heal you. Just like you deceive yourself, harm yourself, or seek a pathway out of the prison of your deluded life. Turn to confront these figures as projections of your own self, as actors in the dream of your own life. Every move of yours changes their stance, intent, and ability. A wrong move invites harm, but a right move could open the next door. Can you recognize these figures as projections of your own self? Discover the key to unlock the mystery of each alluring and frightening figure on your journey. Get ready for the greatest game. The game of your life. When you have resolved each figure and incorporated its power and secret, the game resolves itself, and you arise, O divine child, as one who remembers and sees the way clear, Gear up now and begin your quest. The room went dark and quiet. Wow, Greg exclaimed. That's intense. I like your intro pitch. So, with that as a kickoff to the first reading, let us gear up and begin our quest through some other readings. I'll just say very quickly that it gets introduced throughout the book very early on that many people at Bayside Village are very, you could say in some cases, advanced adepts, and they've taken a sort of a mission and mandate to bring spiritual teaching right into the fabric, the deep fabric, the underlying fabric of civilization, and to grow something new. So Jeff says earlier to Greg that these are archetypal training games. These are not superficial games. These are games about training the soul. The next reading, and if anybody has questions or comments, just stop.
I have a question. I'm interested when you talk about bringing a spiritual teaching into the day-to-day life. What does that mean for you in terms of, you know, outside of the context of the novel? I mean, how do you operationalize that, or how do you?
So I could say in a few ways. I sit with people from companies and professors just in the ordinary course of my work. I try to carry a practice of presence, I'm not communicating any content. I'm actually rather quiet about my practice, except if I find the right situation. Sometimes you just can't talk about certain things. But I try to hold a certain inner attention, and there's an inner practice that I do as I'm in the midst of a meeting with a company and with a faculty member. That's the work I do. I would say this writing this novel is also part of, for me, a vision of service to humanity. It's something that I want to inspire, to motivate. I'm not in the position that Roger or Greg in the novel are in. I'm not in a position to make a direct technological spiritual integration. I tried to build a Linet. And at one point someone said, and I don't have any computer science background, I can't do coding or programming. So someone said to me, well, you write well, why don't you try to write a novel and build a fan community around it? Somebody else will pick up the idea and maybe it'll get funded that way. So I guess in that sense, a novel is one of my best takes at it. But I think just being an ordinary, everyday person in a mundane work setting and trying to carry a different quality of presence is how I do it. Is that what you're asking about?
That's clear. I guess part of the question I have is also that ordinary life, as we might describe it, tends to have agendas that are anything but spiritual.
Yeah.
And tend to promote activities and fixations of attention that move us away from presence.
Mm-hmm.
And so trying to hold presence in a context that doesn't have by its nature a natural support or understanding of presence is certainly good personal work, but it's also a source of ongoing friction.
Yes.
And so I guess, you know, maybe at first I'm just acknowledging that, and also I guess an open question for myself is to what extent is it possible to actually infuse a sort of a material business environment with a sensibility of presence such that other possibilities are available?
Yeah, I clearly wrestle with the same question. Mm-hmm. I've lived monastically in a Zen center and in a yoga ashram, and also in three Christian communities that were really a little bit more around social activism than really deep spiritual practice, let alone training. So really the training was in the Zen and yogic contexts. And I've visited very many other monasteries and ashrams and other different kinds of centers. And in those kinds of residential settings, you have quite a supportive surrounding atmosphere. And you don't have to be challenged by the different kinds of priorities that are there competing for your attention. I think also of family life, having children who, you know, you can't shelter children forever. They get into things, and you know, you're inevitably drawn deeper into life in ways that raise crucial questions. And it has always seemed to me that it's more challenging than living in a supportive environment where you have a Zen center or something like that, to reinforce, to mirror back, to affirm, where there's a different kind of conversation that's possible. Different kinds of activities are rewarded and supported. Bayside Village and the Bridge Institute are, you could say, a supportive container. I'm not going to get into probably enough readings tonight, but some of the depth and fondness of friendship that is possible in a setting like this, where people are colleagues in an everyday sense, working on a technology platform or working to administer a utopian community or to provide a meal program or something like that, and yet at the same time have a deep underlying shared system of core values about practice, about holding something different. So that is a kind of a supportive container. But it's hard being in the midst of a corporation today, or a university, or some other setting where there's just no mirroring back.
Yeah, I think the other question I have is that in the Silicon Valley technology world, it's becoming more trendy to focus on mindfulness, and there are groups that get together and meetups for talking about consciousness hacks and things like that, and yet there's also, in some of it, which is not by no means a generalization of everybody, but there's also an egoic quality to some of those manifestations. And I'm interested, you know. So I guess the question, maybe to resolve the question, is: I hear you saying a lot about the idealism of possibly having technologies of enlightenment or technologies of consciousness.
I would say that support.
Yeah, that support. Yeah. And yet, those very technologies, by their nature, also have a tendency to create a kind of commodification of something that's an ultimately subjective and unique, non-replicable experience.
Yeah.
And that tension is there because the minute it becomes commodified, then it becomes the domain of the mind to sort of replicate for egoic purposes, as opposed to allow to be, to cultivate a deeper kind of encounter with oneself.
Yes, I do struggle with that. If you extend some of these ideas further that I'm developing, and you could even say things like, what about conscious business practices that are out there today? Conscious capitalism. I mean, how far can that go? You know, can you really be in service of some? I mean, are there limits to being in service of something greater if you're beholden to shareholders and maximizing profit? How far can that go? I'm hopeful that mindfulness movements in law, in Silicon Valley, tech world, in medicine, and other places may eventually make a shift. That at some point someone will get deep enough in mindfulness to say, this is starting to get down to my fundamental values, and maybe this isn't the best way to do medicine, or maybe this isn't the best way to do practice law or develop new technologies. But then what I'm interested in with sacred science, which is beyond mindfulness. In fact, I did not bring Zen into Alignit. I developed traditions that have a sacred science. I talked about Buddhism, yoga, Vedanta, Tantra. Tantra, Ayurveda, Taoism, Sufism, and some Western esoteric traditions and an ancient esoteric type of Christianity called Nestorian Christianity. That's kind of an exception. That I don't know how much sacred science there is there. But with all of these, there is an amplified metaphysics and cosmology. With Zen and with mindfulness, and you don't have metaphysics. There's an implicit metaphysics, but you don't have systems. And so I would think if I'm a technologist, or programmer or a venture capitalist or sitting in Silicon Valley, and I'm thinking, okay, mindfulness, my value set might be shifting because of the practice of mindfulness, but what is going to be a guide for a different kind of technology development? Mindfulness doesn't give you everything. And so in Buddhism, for instance, there's very vast maps of systems that one of my interests is, can we go back to some of those? They're medieval, but can we update them?
Is it a system as opposed to an ethics? I mean, it's like there's an ethics underlying. Mm-hmm. When I hear you say sacred science, I think of a science that's at least largely infused by some sort of ethical foundation, such
mm-hmm.
that there's a basis for assessing impact and consequences of activities and discoveries that are made.
Yeah.
And today, I guess my critique of mindfulness
mm-hmm.
as it's dropped into the business culture is that it's been sort of denatured from any sort of semblance of ethics
yeah.
in the pursuit of secularizing something so that it would be acceptable in those contexts.
Mm-hmm.
But by making it acceptable in those contexts, you've also eliminated that thread that sort of ties it back to being a technology in support of a spiritual awakening.
Yeah.
And Buddhism, I think, has that principle, although I think there's a valid critique to be made that American Buddhism goes a lot further than, let's say, Japanese or Chinese mm-hmm. Buddhism or Indian Buddhism in severing that connection to an ethical foundation.
Yeah.
Not entirely, obviously, but so it's, how do you get that back into the conversation? I mean, I guess I'm hearing you say that that's part of what you're trying to do with the concept of the sacred science as opposed to a reductionist materialist science.
Yeah, and also what I'm trying to do in response to partial importations of Eastern teachings, like, let's just apply mindfulness. Well, great, but mindfulness is part of a larger system that has a robust ethics. And there's a lot that we leave behind or sever, because it's easier to just do aerobic yoga and not yoga philosophy and devotion and yantras and mantras and all these kinds of things. So I actually do explore ethics. I took it out of this book. I am planning it for a sequel. What would happen, for instance, if you had a Buddhist-based ethics as a reference point for bioethics, for animal research? Can you, can you really work on animals with a Buddhist-based ethos? Non-harming, or ahimsa in Indian traditions. So I think there's a lot. Yeah, I'm very interested in that greater wholeness of spiritual traditions and not just taking bits we like because they work well in American culture, or it's easier to start off with that, but then let's mature the bring in more.
I mean, we obviously, in the context of this bookstore, we are kind of a hub for a lot of different traditions,
mm-hmm.
and seeing people who Americanize traditions and people who are deep practitioners with a very strong linkage to a lineage within a tradition.
Mm.
And it's an interesting question because people are, American culture at large likes to take things that it likes and to utilize it for whatever period of time it's of interest.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's allowing that thing to... people don't necessarily allow themselves to be used by a tradition.
Yep.
They tend to want to utilize a tradition for an end.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as there's that relationship, it tends to be more, as I said, commodified.
Mm-hmm.
There's more of a transactional basis to the engagement as opposed to a basis of surrender.
Yeah.
So let me then pursue a point that Stuart just made, which is that in the novel, in your novelization of these ideas, do you explore how these things might, in fact, how a sacred science might, in fact, be effectively incorporated into the operation of an institution, even though this is, I guess, from the description, kind of peripheral to the central focus of an institution like UC Berkeley, in a way. Nevertheless, it arises from and is connected to that sort of mainstream institution. So is that part of your direction that you're attempting to cultivate in this book?
Yes. The approach I've taken is, you think about, you know, I guess coming from the 1960s, you know, you got all these sort of revolutionary ideas in the culture. Maybe that's the latest, most recent period of revolutionary thinking that we're familiar with. And so you have a bunch of people go out to the woods and have a hippie commune, and then it dissipates. It's not sustainable. And so how do you, you know, all these grand ideas, you know, romantic ideas, let's go back to nature, or let's, you know, change this or change that. And you know, we have Whole Foods now. That's a shift, you know. But you know what? How do you really make and sustain change? And so I guess one of the things that I've tried, that I'm taking as an approach, is explore utopian ideas. I don't really say how much about this. I haven't said about this very much yet, but taking utopian ideas as a way of studying civilizational possibilities, and to stimulate civilizational thinking, creativity. But Bayside Village is a place for incubating new ideas that could be tried out. Then the question is, well, how then do you? And Bayside Village is an alternative community in a way, but it's not intending to be separatist. It's not intending to be a place out in the woods. It's right in the middle of the Bay Area. It participates in larger networks of technology exchange, philosophical discourse, and so on. Has visiting scholar engagements. So how do you scale up? How do you recommend things? How do you say, well, here's, we've made a demonstration of something at a small scale. This could be scalable. And we're looking for partners to take this on and to try to mainstream this kind of an idea. One of the things that I had conceived but hadn't—I think I took it out of this novel. I just had—it's saved for a sequel. Is having business students and law students work on. Okay, so I mean, I see this all the time at Berkeley. Actually, somebody in a technology field has developed a great new technology, but they don't think about all angles of it. What about ethical implications? What about social implications? Does this, you know, everybody's interested in breakthrough innovation, disruptive innovation, even. A big book by Clay Christensen came out on disruptive innovation, I think, in 2001. So, well, what are we disrupting? And is all disruption good? Maybe some, I mean, we see a lot of disruption of traditional systems as modern Western culture moves to developing countries. Is it all good? A lot of disruption is very devastating. So how do you get a bunch of people in a team effort to look at the, you know, legal implications, business implications, societal implications, and even looking at it, you know, spiritually? What is the potential of this, and what will it serve? What will it do? So that's kind of a team or cohort-based approach to the development of a new technology, not just scaling it. I guess that's kind
partly,
of...
Partly, I mean, what... The metaphor that comes up for me out of what you just said is a sort of a metaphor of conversation. So,
yeah.
So to use the example you just alluded to, somebody comes up with some great new, presumably computer science technology or something like
yeah.
that, and they don't think about the social implications
yeah.
and and so forth. And if I'm hearing you correctly, then the idea behind this, I don't know if the institution is the right word, this institution or this creation of Bayside Village is to create a vastly wider conversation about these sorts of things. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, I think there already is a mechanism in universities for technology transfer. I mean, you can think of the medieval university as being kind of an ivory tower standing almost apart from even being exploiting the society around it. But the scholars were not thinking necessarily about how to influence the good of society. In some sense, this begins in utopian works, perhaps in the 1600s, where you have Francis Bacon in the New Atlantis conceiving of a new society and a new research institute where they're thinking about how do we do this for the good of all? I mean, not just in an ivory tower sense. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, I've never really traced the development, but eventually you get to a place where in the United States you have land-grant institutions, and the federal government said, well, you can have this land, you can start a state university and have federal funding, you can have this land, but you have to also serve the public good, and that's where we have extensions, you know, like an agricultural extension. So this is intended to be, you know, town and gown, or you know, the university going out into the world and sharing something and products of research that can be useful in practical arts. So in that sense, there's already kind of a model of movement out from university to the world. And then there's a whole field called technology transfer, which in my mind is rather myopic in that it focuses mainly on commercial interests. But it's, you could say it's anchored in the public good. You know, we're developing this new therapeutic in the lab, and it could save lots of lives. Well, the main thing is it's going to make a lot of money. You know, but really, if you come down to core values,
it's going to make the university a lot of money.
It's going to make the university a lot of money. It's going to make companies a lot of money that license it.
Right, yeah.
And so it's, you know, people whitewash and say, well, it's all great values, yeah, but you know, mm-hmm. we know what really goes on there. Not that those values aren't there, but there's a lot else going on as well.
But that gets back to this question of, you know, will that same model work for incubating a spiritual idea? Because what's the driver to push it out and have it scale?
Right. I did address that directly, actually, in the novel. There is a function of technology transfer at the Bayside Village, and it's it also is reconceptualized from the standpoint of being in support of the development of sacred science and developing technologies for not only the public good as we think about it in a secular framework, but truly the good of society from many larger perspectives, and the development of the soul. You could even say from a Gnostic standpoint, even to the point of the return journey home or something like that. So the Bayside Village isn't incubating spiritual ideas per se. It's incubating economic, technological, and other kinds of social.
Not right livelihood, are you saying, or something like that, in part?
Yes.
Okay.
In developments of it. So there's a Buddhist idea of right livelihood. How can we push that farther?
So I think of organizations like, is it Kiva that does the microeconomic mm-hmm. ones?
Yeah.
So in a way, that would be a good model of what you're talking about, of taking
yes.
a higher ideal, which is mm-hmm. empowering people who are at the very lowest levels of the socioeconomic pyramid on the planet,
yep.
and giving them the resources in order to gain independence such that they can have a sense of personal control over their material needs.
Yep.
And so that would be a spiritual ideal that's being enabled through a reconfigured ordinary model of extending loans, only mm-hmm. doing it on a unconventional way, which is small amounts to people who have very little.
Yes. So that's an example of an idea that could have been incubated at Bayside Village,
okay.
and then find a partner to scale up, and then, okay, that's launched, and that's out there, and then now people are moving on to another project, just like in the university world, you move on to your next grant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we have a, how much longer do we have? I might like to read one more.
Oh, go for it. Piece. Yeah, like, you know, 20, 25 minutes.
Okay. So I'll read maybe one or two other pieces to give a flavor. I just read one so far, which is about gaming. It kind of just gets an introduction. This one is a Tibetan Buddhist meeting, so we're getting right into a spiritual tradition. What I've tried to do in many of these is to give to show how spiritual traditions of one kind or another might be extended or amplified. Or I don't know if I'll have enough time to go into one. It might be in which a teacher of yantras is actually using a linnet very explicitly and shares with Greg how he's trying to figure out how to use this with his students. So I'll save that. I might get to that. But this is a Tibetan Buddhist meeting. Greg and Sarah wake up early Wednesday morning and they take their daughter Tara to this meeting. And what I'm trying to do in each of these is give a little bit of a taste of traditional practice, and there's a technology or something that shows, oh, here's a way of extending, here's a way of doing something different, not with technology co-opting practice, or not with like, oh, gee, here's a new technology, everything new must be great, but is there really something that can be done that is an expression of practice? The very creation of it is one's own practice. And maybe even the technology itself can be enabling of something like Kiva, like microloans, or something like that. The setting, the scene here is a temple. It's a multipath temple, and I'll just start out. So before dawn, Greg opened his eyes in bed. He stretched and looked over to Sarah, who lay. Excuse me. He stretched and looked over to Sarah, who lay asleep beside him on her stomach, her bare shoulders over the pillow, her long brunette hair fanned over her arms. Greg gently caressed Sarah's back to rouse her. Sarah moaned in a half-asleep way. "Okay," she said, stirring. As dawn broke, the family walked to the temple that Greg and Sarah toured on Monday, and down the hall to the Tibetan Buddhist room. A small group of people removed their shoes outside the door and placed them on a rack. Greg, Sarah, and Tara did the same, Sarah helping with Tara's shoes. Inside the room, a woman at the front with a shaved head and robes of saffron and maroon was laughing with others who were getting seated on maroon cushions. Greg approached another woman near the back, also in robes. "Hi, we're visiting for the first time." "Oh, welcome to our Sangha," the nun said with a smile, putting her hands together with prayer beads in hand and giving a slight bow. Greg returned the gesture. "We've been to other Buddhist meetings, including Vajrayana meetings, but we're not familiar with your practice here. Do we just sit anywhere?" "You can sit anywhere. If you want, you can sit next to me there, next to me and follow along. I'm sitting right there in the front row," she pointed. "Oh, okay," Greg said. He looked, saw two rows of cushions. "I'm Tenzin Jorchu, by the way." "Oh, I'm Greg, and this is my wife Sarah and my daughter Tara." Sarah smiled and gave a bow, and the nun returned the gesture. Greg, Sarah, and Tara turned and sat down on the maroon cushions in front, Greg sitting next to Tenzin Jorchu's cushion, Tara on the other side of him, and Sarah on the next cushion down. Greg and Sarah both sat in meditation for a few silent moments, and Tara sat, imitating the meditation position. I meant to say this at the beginning. In this section, I'm doing something with the child, which is to, with each spiritual tradition that I explore, I'm trying to give a way, an instance or a window in to what do I mean by sacred sciences, and what is the deep structure that align it as an ontology platform is built to reflect. What is Alignet reflecting? So I'm trying to give windows in, and so this Tibetan Buddhist meeting is one window in, and in this particular window, with the child Tara sitting there, it's less philosophical in some way than some of the others, which get very at a pretty high level of discourse, very abstract. But here, there's the interaction between with the child is something that kind of lightens it and makes it perhaps more approachable. I was going to say that at the beginning. So here they are sitting on meditation cushions. Tara tugged at Greg's shirt. "Daddy?" she whispered. Greg opened his eyes and leaned his shoulder and head toward her. "When is it going to start?" "In a few minutes." And Tara's 5. "Why are you starting already?" "I try to meditate always and everywhere." As the response satisfied Tara or mystified her, Greg resumed his posture and closed his eyes again. Tara tugged on his shirt. "Daddy?" Greg leaned down again. "Yes?" "Are those Buddhas?" Tara asked, pointing ahead to a row of Buddha statues arranged directly in front of the cushions, a row of them, each a different color, each holding different items in their hands. "Yes, those are Buddhas." "Why are there so many?" Greg improvised. "Each one has a gift for us." "And, why are they different colors?" "Each Buddha is a different color because each one has a different gift." "What kind of gift?" "Oh, like happiness, joy, laughter, love." "Are they going to give it to us?" "I think so, yes. We're going to sing and chant, and let's see what happens. I think the Buddhas give gifts from their heart, like love." Just then, Tenzin Gyorchu sat down on the cushion next to Greg. She wrapped her robes around her knees ceremoniously, leaned her torso to the right and then to the left, stretched her neck to the right and left, and then stabilized in the middle. When she finished, she leaned to Greg and opened a chant book on the small table before him. "We start here, on page 3, with taking refuge, and the four immeasurable thoughts. When we get to the Bodhisattva and Tantric vows," she said, flipping pages ahead to show him, "we ask that these are recited only by those who have taken their vows. Have you taken vows?" "In my heart, over the years, yes, but not formally before a Sangha." "Okay, just follow along with me if you want until we get there. And here's a really fun way for your daughter to participate," she said with a smile. Tenzin Gyorchu reached to the other side of her and produced a bell. She turned around again and said to Tara, "Would you like to ring this bell?" Tara nodded her head. "Why don't I give it to your dad, and the two of you can ring it together as when we chant." Do you see the symbols on the side of the page?" Tenzin Gyorchu pointed to the symbols in the margins. "This is the bell, and when you see this by the words, you ring the bell. And this picture stands for the Damaru right here," she said, holding up hers. "When you see the symbols of the Damaru in the margin, I will strike this. So why don't you work with your dad to ring the bell at the right time, okay?" Tara nodded her head. She had a part to play, and this was interesting and important. The nun at the front sat down in the same row, facing the Buddhas and an empty raised chair for a lama who wasn't there. The room quieted, and she spoke aloud. "Become aware of your breath." The room fell silent, and deep breaths could be heard. "Become aware of your motivation, keeping in mind the wish for liberation for yourself and for all sentient beings. Hold the noble thought to practice for your own happiness and the happiness of all sentient beings." After another moment of silence, the pure and sonorous sound of a struck bell rang through the room. "Let's chant the refuges on page 3. I'll skip down just a little bit. So they do this for about 45 minutes, and then they get up, and some people are doing their prostrations, and some people are doing another practice. The other nun came to talk to Greg and Sarah. She was shorter than the first, seemed a practical, grounded woman. "Have you seen our holographic mandala?" "No," Greg said. He imagined, by having observed her earlier, that she would be a keeper of the space, a maintenance person, an operations person. "Let me show you." She walked to one corner of the room with a limp, and the family followed her to a raised square platform of 5 feet by 5 feet, just 3 feet from the ground. "You've seen sand mandalas created by monks?" "Yes," Sarah said, and Greg nodded. "This mandala is made by the monks, but it's made of light and projected holographically." She flipped a switch by the wall. An elegant and dazzling show of laser light revealed a high-resolution mandala in 3 dimensions, pulsating and moving, unfolding across the table as if monks were now pouring colored sand in high speed. Its rays of light were so brilliant, so intense, the mandala looked made up of gems. "Wow," Sarah said. "It's beautiful." She paused, enamored. Tara's eyes were transfixed. Greg studied the structure, the symbols, impressed by the brilliance. He traced the outer doors or gates, followed the pathways in toward the center. Tara asked Greg to pick her up. "Are they artists?" Sarah asked. "The monks? Some are," the nun said. "Some are computer scientists, some work with visual computing, some work with projection technologies. They apply the same inner effort and work from the same Dharma teaching in constructing the mandala." They stood discussing the brilliant 3D light mandala. Then the nun said, "And here is the practice of non-attachment to form." She flipped the switch and the projection blinked out. "Bye-bye, mandala," Greg said to Tara in his arms. "Wow," Sarah said. "It's amazing that you can create such beauty with light." "We can create beauty with anything if we know how," the nun said. Sarah said, contemplating. Then she looked to the nun. "Do you mind if we walk around the room and look at the tankas before we go?" "Please, be our guest. The room is locked up after this until tonight, so now is a perfect time." I'll skip down just a bit. Greg and Tara walked around the room, slowly around the room, Tara still in Greg's arms, looking at the tankas hanging on the walls, displaying the pantheon of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and great yogis in the Nyingma lineage. "Oh, there's my mirror," Greg said, stopping before a busy tanka. "The Wheel of Life." "Your mirror?" Sarah asked. "Yeah, it shows suffering in different realms of deluded existence. I don't remember all the realms, but it's like anger, greed, delusion, the three poisons. It shows the ignorance of our samsaric existence." Sarah contemplated a moment. "There are the hell realms," Greg said, pointing to the bottom of the wheel. "I can't remember all the realms. Animal realm, human realm, Devic realm, Asuric realm, hungry ghost realm." "Hungry ghost?" Tara cut in, obviously attentive, picking up what she could. "Yes, see here," Greg pointed. "See, their bellies are really big, which means they're really hungry. But look at their necks. They're long and really skinny. This means their throats can't swallow very much food. Imagine if you were really, really hungry, but you couldn't swallow because your throat was really, really thin. So these poor hungry ghosts can never eat as much as they want. They never get as much food as they hunger for, and they suffer a lot." Sarah uttered to herself, studying the familiar image. "But why your mirror?" "I don't know. It reminds me of my more frequent states, I guess. Or at least it reminds me of all these realms are potential places we go, not just ordinary consensus reality and a simple heaven and hell. It's just a reminder to keep me humble." "Well, they're all our mirrors, aren't they? All the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, saints, whatever. Aren't we supposed to have Buddha nature already, except that our ignorance clouds the clear light of the sun?" "Yeah, I guess you're right," Greg said. "Good point." He looked ahead, taking in a visual sweep of the other tankas before him. And I guess I'll stop there. There's actually a longer section where they go kind of tanka by tanka and reflect on, and it's kind of a way of showing, again, different windows. So this is setting up, you know, here's a structure, the Sri Yantra, and you know, this can be modeled as an ontology. And here's another structure, the eight Buddhas, or the eight Buddha families, and so on and so on. So, yes?
You touched on the subject of ontology at the beginning, I've never quite understood how the classical ontology, say, like Aristotle's category, maps onto something like computer science or speculatively. Computer science, would it be what are the fundamental categories of relationship in the way a program works? Is that how? is that the connection?
Okay. I'm not an ontologist. I'm a philosopher, but I'm not a computer ontologist. But I've worked near to some of these projects, so I'm hoping that I give a technically accurate enough description. Ontology is the study of things that exist. So if for instance, you're trying to, well, we are Google and Yahoo and a lot of different companies are trying to build an Internet of Things. So this is going to be the new version of the Internet as an Internet of Things. Well, how do you relate things? or how do you have a fully electronic intelligent kitchen? How do your appliances talk to each other? How do you have intelligent vehicles that talk to roadway signals? You have to have some way of modeling things that exist and how they need to relate to each other if they're going to be communicating. How do cars communicate to each other? This is the future. How do cars communicate to buses? How do they communicate to signals and so on, emergency vehicles? So you have to have a way of representing all of these things. Now, I've never seen this distinction, but I would make a distinction between what I might call a natural ontology, like modeling a protein, the constituents of a protein, versus modeling something like social systems or modeling airport traffic or medical ontology strikes me as a little bit more like an ontology of something that is repeatable and something that proteins have similar structure no matter where you are, but airports might have similar features, but they might be built in different locations, and some airports might have some features and not others. So, but an ontology in a computer science world is a way of defining what exists, what their properties are, what the structures, functions, relationships, in order that you can then run operations. That there may be other ways of technically stating that, and that's my best at this moment.
In classical ontology,
mm-hmm.
it's not. It's talking about. In order for something to exist, it has to fall within one of these categories. Like Aristotle's claim was that something either had to be quantitative or qualitative or extended, or those were his ten categories. So that everything in existence would fall within the domain of one of those ten categories. That was his view. And it's really influential down to the present day. So applying that into a computer context. Everything on Facebook, everything that appears on Facebook, has to fall within a certain category of presence. I'm trying to make a bridge between maybe I'm trying to be too rigorous. Maybe the way the computer science is using ontology isn't the way Aristotle used it. Maybe it's just analogical. It's not.
I couldn't speak for the whole field. It is a relatively new field. So you have people. You can imagine that philosophy and computer science are in entirely different colleges, right?
Right.
I mean, humanities versus engineering.
Yeah.
What is a trained ontologist? There's a whole discussion at the NSF, NIST, National Institute of Science and Technology. There's an ontolog forum, which is an ongoing discussion over the last 10 years with just these kinds of questions. And most ontologists, most people working in the ontology space are engineers, don't have philosophical training. There are a few people who have philosophical training who've gone over to consult to people practicing ontology in a computer science setting. It's all very complex, both on the computer science side and the philosophy side. I do actually, one of the readings I might have done tonight was kind of a play on, Greg is walking into Roger's office. He has two offices, an academic office and an Alignet office where he's building this thing. And he walks into his academic office and he sees that above his computer display area, it's not an actual physical peripheral, but the place where he displays on a wall the image of the ontology that he's building. He has above that a very large picture of 64 I Ching hexagrams.
Yeah.
And Greg is utterly fascinated. He says, do you know how significant that is? Because Gottfried Leibniz patterned his Characteristica Universalis on the I Ching. And Roger doesn't know what he's talking about. And he says, this is the history of computation. This is a whole lineage that goes back to Raymond Lully, which is actually on the book image.
Uh-huh.
This is the image on the cover of Alignet, Raymond Lully's image from Ars Magna. up through Giordano Bruno and up through Gottfried Leibniz, and they start getting into people who are really doing formal computation, and you get the beginning of the computer. So Greg is thrilled about this. But so this is kind of, I'm trying to trace a philosophical lineage, and I don't, I mean, it's just one attempt and it's fictional, and I'm sure, I don't know that it's been done. And I don't, I suspect that this is something that is still maturing.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that might be a nice, do I have closing thoughts? Yes, did you?
I've been a utopian my whole life.
Uh-huh.
I actually live in my utopian village here.
Uh-huh.
Can I tell you how we do it?
Sure.
We do it by making conversation itself into a spiritual practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way of being there all the time. And it involves balancing silence with speech. It involves communicating what's going on inside of us non-verbally, pre-verbally, with hand gestures. It involves toning the conversation like a musical instrument.
Mm.
And so that no one is left out.
Mm.
It's about inclusion. I've written about it.
Mm.
And I know where I want to get to.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is always, how do we get from here to there? And what I've learned is that when I find myself in what I call the conversation of my soul, I'm there.
Yeah.
I'm in my community. I'm in my utopian place.
Mm.
So that perspective has me looking at the moment.
Mm.
Always. And writing sentences like, the moment is its own religion, or the moment is its own utopia, its own place.
Mm.
And something is keeping us from there. And it's our conversational practice.
Mm.
I like saying that each religion, each spirituality, each discipline is its own conversation with the essential character of existence, so that the spirituality of conversation itself then strings them all together.
Mm-hmm.
into a new kind of unity.
That's really nice. I mean it makes me think about not just changing the content of the discourse, but changing the way we fundamentally relate and have conversation.
Exactly.
And how conversations can be amazing ways of shifting how we show up together.
Exactly.
And what we do in this world.
Exactly.
Yeah, I like that. It's beautiful.
I'll share some.
I would like that. Thank you. Yeah. Is this
any
a good place?
Questions? Then I guess we have concluded. So thank you on behalf of Many Rivers. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And of course, there are copies of the book that can be purchased. I guess they're all here. Usually we have them over here.
There's a box right there.
Oh, and a box there as well. We should have a donation bowl over there. We will shortly have a donation bowl over there. We encourage you to contribute to it, because half of that we share with our speaker, if nothing else, to pay for his gas from Berkeley or wherever.
No, from here.
And then retain half to maintain this space for further such events. And we are grateful for all of you coming tonight, and look forward to seeing you again at the store at various times, including our speaker. Thank you so much.
Thank you.